It was after dark when John Pierce knocked again at the door of the monk's cell. "The general has returned, Mademoiselle de Thierry. I have told him you are here, and he wishes to speak to you as soon as possible." Santin followed the aide-de-camp down the cloisters and into the large refectory, which had been converted into the regimental operations room. Half a dozen officers were poring over the large-scale map that had been spread over one of the refectory tables. The map was porcupined with coloured pens, and the atmosphere in the room was tense and charged. As Santin entered, the officers glanced up at her, but even a young and pretty girl could not hold their attention for more than a few seconds, and they returned to their tasks. On the far side of the room, General Sean Courtney was standing with his back to her. His jacket, resplendent with red tabs and insignia and ribbons, hung over the chair on which he was resting one booted foot. He leaned his elbow on his knee and scowled furiously at the earpiece of a field telephone from which a faint, distorted voice quacked at him. Sean wore a woollen singlet with sweat-stained armpits and marvellously flamboyant embroidered braces, decorated with stags and running hounds, over his shoulders. He was chewing on an unlit Havana cigar, and suddenly he bellowed into the field telephone without removing the cigar from his mouth. "That is utter horse shit! I was there myself 2 hours ago. I know. I need at least 4 more batteries of 25-pounders in that gap, and I need them before dawn. Don't give me excuses. Just do it, and tell me when it's done." He slammed down the handset and saw Santin. "My dear." His voice altered, and he came to her quickly and took her hand. "I was worried. The chateau has been completely destroyed. The new front line runs not a mile beyond it." He paused and studied her for a moment. What he saw reassured him, and he asked, "Your father?" She shook her head.
"He was killed in the shelling."
"I'm sorry," Sean said simply, and turned to John Pierce. "Take Mr. Thierry through to my quarters." Then to her, "I will follow you in 5 minutes." The general's room opened directly into the main refectory, so that with the door open, Sean Courtney could lie on his cot and watch everything that went on in his operations room. It was sparsely furnished, just the cot and a desk, with 2 chairs and his locker at the foot of the cot. "Won't you sit here, mademoiselle?" John Pierce offered her one of the chairs, and while she waited, Santin glanced round the small room. The only item of interest was the desk. On it stood a hinged photograph frame, one leaf of which contained the picture of a magnificent, mature woman with dark Jewish beauty. It was inscribed across the bottom corner, "Come home safely to your loving wife, Ruth." The second leaf of the frame held a picture of a girl of about Santin's age. The resemblance to the older woman was apparent. They could only be mother and daughter, but the girl's beauty was marred by a petulant, spoiled expression. The pretty mouth had a hard, acquisitive quirk to it, and Santin decided that she did not like her very much at all. "My wife and daughter," Sean Courtney said from the doorway. He had put on his jacket and was buttoning it as he came in. "You have eaten?" he asked as he sank into the chair opposite Santin.
"Yes, thank you."
Santin stood up and picked up the silver box of Vestas from the desk, struck one, and held it for him to light the Havana. He looked surprised, then leaned forward and sucked the flame into the tip of the cigar. When it was well lit, he leaned back in the chair and said, "My daughter Storm does that for me." Santin blew out the match, sat down again, and waited quietly for him to enjoy the first few puffs of fragrant smoke. He had aged since their last meeting, or perhaps it was only that he was very tired, she thought.
"When did you last sleep?" she asked,
and he grinned. Suddenly he looked 30 years younger. "You sound like my wife."
"She is very beautiful."
"Yes," Sean nodded and glanced at the photograph, then back to Santin. "You have lost everything," he said, the chateau, my home, and my father. She tried to be calm, not let the terrible hurt show. You have other family, of course.
Of course, she agreed. My uncle lives in Lyon, and I have 2 aunts in Paris.
I will arrange for you to travel to Lyon.
No.
Why not?
He looked piqued at her abrupt refusal. I don't want to go to Lyon or Paris. I am going to Africa.
Africa? Now he was taken aback. Africa? Good Lord, why Africa?
Because I promised Michel. We promised each other we would go to Africa.
But my dear... He dropped his eyes and studied the ash of his cigar. She saw the pain that the mention of Michael's name inflicted. She shared it with him for a moment and then said,
You are going to say, but Michael is dead?
He nodded. Yes. His voice was almost a whisper.
I promised Michel something else, General. I told him that his son would be born in the sunshine of Africa.
Slowly, Sean lifted his head and stared at her. Michael's son?
His son.
You are bearing Michael's child?
Yes.
All the stupid, mundane questions rushed to his lips. Are you sure? How can you be certain? How do I know it's Michael's child? And he bit them back. He had to have time to think, to adjust to this incredible twist of fate. Excuse me. He stood up and limped back into the operations room. Are we in contact with the 3rd Battalion yet? He demanded of the group of officers. We had them for a minute, then lost them again. They are ready to counterattack, sir, but they need artillery support. Get on to those damned shell wallers again, and keep trying to get through to Caithness. He turned to another of his staff. Roger, what is happening to the 1st?
No change, sir. They have broken 2 enemy attacks, but they are taking a beating from the German guns. Colonel Stevens think they can hold.
Good man, Sean grunted.
It was like trying to close the leaks in a dike, holding back the ocean with handfuls of clay. But somehow they were doing it, and every hour they held on was blunting the cutting edge of the German attack.
The guns are the key. If we can get them up soon enough, how is the traffic on the main road?
Clearing and moving faster, it seems, sir.
If they could move the 25-pounders into the gap before morning, then they could make the enemy pay dearly for their gains. They would have them in a salient. They could hit them from 3 sides, pound them with artillery.
Sean felt his spirits droop again. This was a war of guns. It all came back in the end to the bloody attrition of the guns.
At the front of his mind, Sean made the calculations, assessed the risks and the costs, and gave the orders. But behind that, he was making other calculations. He was thinking of the girl and her claims upon him. Firstly, he had to control his natural reaction to what she had told him. For Sean was a son of Victoria, and he expected all people, but especially his own family, to live by the code that had been set in the previous century. Of course, young men were expected to sow their wild oats. By God, Sean himself had sown them by the barrow load, and he grinned shamefacedly at the memory, but decent young men left decent young girls alone until after they were married.
I'm shocked, he realized, and smiled again.
The officers at the operations table saw the smile and looked puzzled and uneasy.
What is the old devil up to now? They exchanged nervous glances. Have you got a hold of Colonel Caithness yet?
Sean covered the smile with a ferocious scowl, and they applied themselves diligently to their tasks once more.
I'm shocked, Sean told himself again, still amused at himself, but this time keeping his face impassive.
And yet Michael himself was your own love baby, the fruit of one of your escapades, your firstborn. The pain of Michael's death assailed him again, but he drove it back.
Now the girl.
He began to think it out.
Is she really pregnant, or is this some elaborate form of blackmail? It did not take him more than a few seconds to decide. I can't be that wrong in my estimate of her. She truly believes she is pregnant. There were areas of the female anatomy and the feminine mind that were completely alien terrain to Sean. He had learned, however, that when a girl believed she was pregnant, she sure as all hell was. How she knew escaped him, but he was prepared to accept it. All right, she's pregnant, but is it Michael's child, and not some other young... Again, his rejection of the idea was swift. She's a child of a decent family, carefully guarded by her father and that dragon of hers. How she and Michael managed it beats me. He almost grinned again as he recalled how often and adroitly he had managed it in his youth, against equally fearsome odds. The ingenuity of young love. He shook his head. All right, I accept it. It's Michael's child, Michael's son. And only then did he allow the joy to rise in him. Michael's son! Something of Michael still lives on. Then he cautioned himself quickly. Steady on now, don't let's go overboard. She wants to come out to Africa, but what the hell are we going to do with her? I can't take her in at Emoyeni. For a moment the image appeared in his mind of the beautiful home on the hill, the place of the wind in Zulu, which he had built for his wife. The longing to be back, there with her, came powerfully upon him. He had to fight it off and apply himself to the immediate problems again. Three of them, three pretty girls, all of them proud and strong-willed, living in the same house. Instinctively he knew that this little French girl and his own beloved but lovingly indulged daughter would fight like two wild cats in a sack. He shook his head. By God, that would be the perfect recipe for disaster, and I wouldn't be there to turn them over my knee. I've got to come up with something better than that. What in the name of all that is holy do we do with this pregnant little filly? Sir, sir, one of the officers called and offered Sean the headset of the field telephone. I've got through to Colonel Caithness at last. Sean snatched the set from him. Douglas, he barked into it. The line was bad. The background hissed and rushed like the sea, so Douglas Caithness's voice seemed to come up from across an ocean. Hello, sir, the guns have just come up. Thank God, Sean growled. I have deployed them, Caithness gave the map reference. They are hammering away already, and the Hun seem to have run out of steam. I'm going to raid them at dawn. Douglas, be careful. There are no reserves behind you. I won't be able to support you before noon. All right, I understand, but we can't let them regroup unopposed. Of course not, Sean agreed. Keep me informed. In the meantime, I'm going up for more batteries and elements of the 2nd Battalion, but they won't reach you before noon. Thank you, sir. We can use them. Go to it, man. Sean handed the instrument back, and while he watched the coloured pins rearranged on the map, the solution to his personal problem came to him. Gary. He thought of his twin brother and felt the familiar twinge of guilt and compassion. Garrick Courtney, the brother whom Sean had crippled. It had happened so many years ago, and yet every instant of that dreadful day was still so clear in Sean's mind that it might have taken place that very morning. The two of them, teenage scamps, arguing over the shotgun that they had stolen out of their father's gunroom and loaded with buckshot as they trotted through the golden grass of the Zululand hills. "I saw the Inkonka first," Gary protested. They were going out to hunt an old bushbuck ram whose lair they had discovered the previous day. "I thought of the shotgun," Sean told him, tightening his grip on the weapon, "so I do the shooting." And of course, Sean prevailed. It was always that way. It was Gary who took Tinker, their mongrel hunting dog, and circled out along the edge of thick bush to drive the antelope back to where Sean waited with the shotgun. Sean heard again Gary's faint shouts at the bottom of the hill and Tinker's frantic barks as he picked up the scent of the wary bushbuck. Then the rush in the grass and the long yellow stems bursting open as the Inconca came out, heading straight up to where Shaun lay on the crest of the hill. He looked immense in the sunlight, for in alarm his shaggy mane was erected, and his dark head with the heavy spiral horns was raised high on the thick, powerful neck. He stood 3 foot high at the shoulder and weighed almost 200 pounds, and his chest and flanks were barred and spotted with delicate patterns, pale as chalk on the dark, rufous ground. He was a magnificent creature, quick and formidable. Those horns were sharp as pikes and could rip the belly out of a man or slice through his femoral artery, and he came straight at Shaun. Shaun fired the choke barrel, and he was so close that the charge of buckshot struck in a solid blast and tore through the animal's barrel chest into lung and heart. The bushbuck screamed and went down, kicking and bleating, its sharp black hooves clashing on the rocky ground as it slid back down the hill. "I got him!" howled Shaun, leaping from his hiding place. "I got him first shot! Gary, I got him!" From below, Gary and the dog came pelting through the coarse golden grass. It was a race as to which of them could get to the dying animal first. Shaun carried the shotgun, the second barrel still loaded, and the hammer at full cock, and as he ran, a loose stone rolled under his foot, and he fell. The gun flew from his grip. He hit the ground with his shoulder, and the second barrel fired with a stunning thump of sound. When Shaun scrambled up again, Gary was sitting beside the dead bushbuck, whimpering. His leg had taken the full charge of buckshot at almost point-blank range. It had hit him below the knee, and the flesh was wet red ribbons, the bone white chips and slivers, and the blood a bright fountain in the sunlight.
Poor Gary, Shaun thought, now a lonely one-legged old cripple.
The woman whom Shaun had put up with child and whom Gary had married before she gave birth to Michael had finally been driven insane by her own hatred and bitterness and died in the flame she herself had set. Now Michael, too, was gone, and Gary had nothing. Nothing, except his books and his scribblings. "I'll send him this bright, pert girl and her unborn infant." The solution came to Shaun with a flood of relief. "At last I can make some retribution for all I have done to him. I will send him my own grandchild, the grandchild I should so dearly love to claim as my own. I'll send to him in part payment." He turned from the map and limped quickly back to where the girl waited. She rose to meet him and stood quietly, her hands clasped demurely in front of her, and Shaun saw the worry and fear of rejection in her dark eyes and the way her lower lip trembled as she waited for his judgment. He closed the door behind him, and he went to her and took her small, neat hands in his great hairy paws, and he stooped over her and kissed her gently. His beard scratched her soft cheek, but she sobbed with relief and flung both arms around him.
"I'm sorry, my dear," he said. "You took me by surprise. I just had to get used to the idea."
Shaun hugged her, but very gently. The mystery of pregnancy was one of the very few things that daunted and awed Shaun Courtney. Then he settled her back in the chair.
"Can I go to Africa?"
She was smiling, though the tears still trembled in the corners of her eyes.
"Yes, of course. That's your home now. For as far as I am concerned, you are Michael's wife. Africa is where you belong."
"I'm so happy," she told him softly.
But it was more than mere happiness. It was a vast sense of security and protection. This man's aura of power and strength was now held over her like a shield.
"You are Michael's wife," he had said. He had acknowledged that, which she herself believed. Somehow his endorsement made it a fact. "This is what I'm going to do. The German U-boats have been playing such havoc. A sailing for you on one of the Red Cross hospital ships that leave directly from the French Channel ports will be the safest way of getting you home.
Anna?
Santin cut in quickly. Yes, of course. She must go with you. I'll fix that also. You will both volunteer for nursing duties, and I'm afraid you'll be expected to work your passage.
Santin nodded eagerly.
Michael's father, my brother, Garrick Courtney, Sean started.
Yes, yes. Michel told me all about him. He is a great hero. He won the cross of the English Queen Victoria for his courage in a battle against the Zulus.
Santin cut in excitedly.
And he is a scholar who writes books of history.
Sean blinked at the description of poor Gary, but of course it was factually correct, and he nodded.
He is also a kind and gentle person, a widower who has just lost his only son.
An almost telepathic understanding passed between them, although Santin knew the truth. From now on, Michael would always be referred to as Garrick, Courtney's son.
Michael was his whole life, and you and I know how he must feel at the loss, for we share it.
Santan's eyes sparkled with unshed tears, and she bit down on her lower lip as she nodded vehemently.
I will cable him. He will be at Cape Town to meet you when the ship docks. I will also give you a letter to take to him. You can be certain of his welcome and his protection, for both you and Michael's child.
Michael's son, said Santin firmly, and then hesitantly. But I will see you also, General, sometimes.
Often, Sean assured her, leaning forward to pat her hand gently. Probably more often than you wish.